And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast live from Los Angeles, California, where we are less than 24 hours removed from the first Kawhi Paul George minutes of the season. And I am thrilled, as I always am, to be joined by another ESPN personality who is in attendance at that game. The one and only, the Hall of Famer, Doris Burke. How are you?
Great. Could not be better. That game was so fun last night, wasn't it, Zach?
Other than the interminable referee reviews,
yes,
which are ruining, I don't know what the solution is. They need a limit or something. They cannot, on the one hand, you and I would both be upset, I think, if we were fans of a team and a game deciding call that could have been reviewed turned out to be wrong.
Right.
But it's just too long.
It's too long. I got a text from an NBA coach who's just like, this is ridiculous. And it's interesting. I thought for the first time I saw visible frustration amongst a group of officials where, at the end of the game, the last out of bounds review that happened, Mark Davis clearly knew whose ball it was, and yet they eventually go to the monitor, and I caught his reaction on a replay, and I was like, wow, I don't know that I've ever seen somebody that physically demonstrative. I knew what it was, and I think for Mark, you know, he knew how that was dragging, and it's hard. It's hard. And then the other thing about these reviews, and this is hard for me to take, and I'm curious your perspective on it, Zach. It's the play where the review came, foul call, Paul George got away with a push-off offensive foul. And a couple of people were like texting me that should have been overturned. And then I see the NBA's version of that play, Zach, where essentially they said the gather hadn't happened and therefore it was not connected to the play. But any logical basketball person would say that is connected to the play and that should be overturned. It's like these coaches hate it. I've not heard one like it. This will be a 1 year experiment is the appropriate.
The
yeah, I think so. I'd be shocked if this is in place next year. Shocked.
Paradoxically, given everything I just said, I kind of like the coach's challenge.
Really? Because of the intrigue?
Just because you only get one. I've had people pitch me that if you use it and you win, you should get another one. Absolutely not. You get one. That's it. But I do like that there's one thing the coaches can play in the last minute of a game. If you would think they're only going to challenge things that are really obvious.
Yes.
And I feel like if something's obvious, we might as well spend a minute on it. But at the same time, I can't take these reviews. It's too long.
One more point though. Just to a level of paranoia that I think is appropriate for coaches anyway. I had one coach, a few short weeks into the season say, this is the percentage of overturned calls. And when you get one overturned, the next call goes against you, say, 75% of the time. And I was hollering. I'm like, okay. Because a lot of these coaches will tell you there's the human dynamic. These officials don't want to be wrong. And if you catch them wrong, that next call is going against you.
It's interesting, though. Those human dynamics are real. So I've spent last week with the Sixers and I was talking to them about many aspects of their team. And one of them is they're fouling a lot.
Yes. And turning it over a lot.
And what came back to me was we don't really care that we're fouling that much because A, there's the old Utah Jazz, like you can't call everything. So we're just going to be super physical.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a human dynamic. The refs don't want to call everything.
Sure.
And number two, they are going to get a ton of foul shots themselves because of the way they play. And their view is the refs are sensitive to a discrepancy that is too big. So we're going to get called for a certain number of fouls anyway. So why not just amp it all the way up? I thought that was very interesting.
Interesting take. Wow.
Not something I would have thought of. What'd you think of the Clippers? The real Clippers, close to the real Clippers. Still no Landry Shamet, who's an important part of their team, but
yes.
Close.
You know, I think it's fascinating that they, meaning Kawhi and Paul, and actually by nature everybody else, they've not had one single moment of competitive preparation prior to last night, literally not one competitive second together. And yet I think you could see some of the basis for the excitement, individual defensive plays and, you know, the gravity of, okay, Paul's on one side, Kawhi's on the other, two defenders are going to one, wide open shot with a simple swing, not a swing, just a swing. What a game. You know, Tom Thibodeau was in attendance, and he walked by me and Mike Breen at the end of the game. He's like, that was like a playoff game. I mean, to get that level of intensity, to get that level of defense, contested shots all over the floor. You know, I feel badly about something I did on the air, and I was sort of zeroed in on Marcus Smart's defensive ability, Zach. And it took me a stretch of time. And listen, in fairness to me, I thought it was Patrick Beverley exerting his will late in the game that made a difference. But I was sort of saying, you know, Rudy Gobert's got Defensive Player of the Year on lockdown, but let's just keep an eye on Marcus Smart as a first-team all-defensive guy a year ago.
He's been. I had him on my podcast 2 days ago.
No,
we haven't posted it yet.
This dude's ridiculous, Zach.
He's
because
ridiculous.
Because they downsize so often, he's getting caught in the post. He's giving up 6 inches. He might give up 40 pounds. I mean, the level of intensity, the level of smarts.
No pun intended.
Yeah, right.
Unavoidable puns with him.
This guy is. I just admire his competitive spirit and willingness to take on every challenge. And there's a level of intelligence across the board with the Celtics and the way they switch and their ability to get out of bad post-up matchups in a split second.
Yeah, they're the best in the league at it.
It is so fun to watch.
So I wanted to talk about the Celtics anyway, so why don't we start there since they're the other team that played last night? If you look at surface level stats, like the time Kemba Walker holds the ball per game versus the time Kyrie Irving held the ball per game, time of his the number of dribbles, the number of passes that the team is throwing per game, all of these things would in the number of touches for Kemba versus Kyrie, all that is like essentially unchanged. Assist rate unchanged.
The time of possession is unchanged, Zach?
Unchanged.
Wow.
Now that stat is a little wonky because so much of a point guard's time of possession is just dribbling the ball
the seven seconds it's coming off a dead ball, whatever. Yeah.
But doesn't it look different?
It looks, and not only does it look different, it feels different, and the entire vibe around the team is entirely different. Now, listen, I go back to the Connecticut days with Kemba because I was still very much immersed in college basketball. I called that run to his Big East championship, and I love Jim Calhoun, but he himself would, you know, admit to he could be cantankerous and competitive and tough, and in the daily grind of a college basketball season, he said, you know, if I'd be in my office and not in a very good mood because of whatever reason, you know, some whatever at UConn, he said inevitably Kemba Walker would walk in the door with that smile on his face and the entire countenance of our office, the tone, the tenor, everything would change. But I had a question for you as it relates to Kemba.
Yes.
I love him, all-star, obviously very capable, you know, can be elite in the fourth quarter. I was fascinated by how easily it seemed to me the Clippers defended him. They met him at the point of the screen. Their individual defenders who are guarding him could get over the screen or just needed a moment for that, you know, secondary defender to just get him a breather for a moment. Even on his drives, you know, twice Zubats string, you know, gets strung out and he just kind of hangs and keeps working and blocks him twice at the rim. And then obviously Kemba got all kinds of separation late. As you saw that, you thought what?
I thought many things. First of all, Kemba has not been in he hasn't been in any big playoff games, really, a couple big playoff games with Charlotte. That was like a playoff. That was like playoff reffing. The physicality that was allowed was like, you better get, this is like what it's going to be. And I think it's good for him to get a taste of that early in the season. I thought the Clippers are huge and so switchable. And that's part of what's fun about this team is when they put, now they had Harkless guarding him, then they had Kawhi guarding him down the stretch when they themselves went smaller with Kawhi at the four. But when you've got Kawhi, PG, Beverly, sometimes Harkless, sometimes not, and then Harrell on the floor, you're going to be able to switch a lot.
A lot.
And just, it's not like, it's, so teams will attack that by saying, okay, who's not switchable? Lou and Trez. Although Trez is a little bit switchable, sneaky switchable. And we'll say, okay, we'll put those guys in a pick and roll. That's what we'll do.
Right.
We'll take,
Celtics went too late.
Right. First of all, the Clippers have something to say about that. They can put Kawhi and PG wherever they want.
Yes.
And second of all, Kawhi and PG on the wing as help defenders is just a menace.
Which side do you want to go to?
Yeah.
Because, oh, by the way, Patrick Beverley, when he saw Brad Wanamaker, who has been so solid for the Celtics, and, you know, you saw last night when he played with Kemba, because Kemba was ineffective in his normal pick-and-roll game, they move him off the ball and start setting him off staggers and trying to, you know, release him other ways, Zach. I would not – I mean, if you're a ball handler who is in any way shaky in terms of your handle, whether you can't – you can only put it in your left hand for one or two dribbles and then you got to come back. Patrick knows this, and he's going to get up underneath you and – to watch that man pressure the ball and know that, okay, Paul and Kawhi can be up the line and have an opportunity to be that defensive back, knowing that quarterback's under pressure.
I don't know which is worse.
Good luck and good night. Well, are you kidding?
I mean, when Kawhi was really the best defensive player on the wing since Scottie Pippen, he hasn't been at that, although I thought he played a very strong game last night.
Excellent defensively last night.
He was getting his hand on the ball from behind. Yeah. He was tenacious.
I didn't know. His wingspan is 4.5 inches longer than a person of his size should be.
Yeah, he's
and his hand size is just whatever, absurdly. Last time I talked about Kawhi's hands on the air, Twitter went nuts, so let's stay away from that topic.
All right. people need to get their minds out of together. He used to just take the ball from people.
Yes.
He used to just be like, if you weren't like a Chris Paul level dribbler, he would just be like, the ball is mine. Thanks for participating in this exercise. And they're going to be really hard to score against. There's no question. I thought it was quite poetic actually last night that the three that sealed the game was Lou Williams, Montrezl Harrell pick and roll. Harrell slips. Lou gives him the pocket pass. Harrell hits Beverly in the corner for a three. So it's the three supporting guys.
That's right.
With Kawhi and Paul George spotting up. Yep. And that's part of what makes this is like when your two best players can both shoot threes at an elite level, it's not that hard to make it work because, you know, PG is not a lead ball handler. He's a great secondary ball handler. He's not a lead ball handler. Like this is easy. They can both spot up. They can take turns, as you said, running pick and rolls and kicking to each other. And when the Lou Trez show is rolling, like they can just turn it over to them and they rode
Lou in the fourth quarter, Zach. I have a question for you because I don't remember him doing this, and I said it was an improvement, and then after the game I was like, are you sure that's an improvement? But like, and I know Montrezl has taken, you know, many steps forward as a player, but to your point about those two guys spaced and the play you're talking about, where Trez gets it just maybe at the free throw line or step inside, and he does not only have the vision, but he's able, like a big on the move to make the catch and the pass. It's almost essential in today's NBA.
Huge, huge.
So could he have done that 2 years ago, do you think?
2 years ago, no. Last year, you definitely started to see it pick up a little bit for him. And even now, you'll see him. So, like, he knows the reads. Like, before he catches the ball, he knows there's a wing shooter and a corner shooter, or maybe it's single side over here. There's only one guy. But sometimes you'll see him caught in between for just a split second. He'll think wing, and then, like, I gotta go to, and that split second, it's over. Yes. But he's definitely gotten better.
Yeah. It's just so important. You know, it's funny. I had a coach say to me last year, it is increasingly difficult to play in the NBA if you do not think the game.
Oh, you have to feel the game now. Mm-hmm. Unless you're just an out of this world shooter.
Right.
And you can just take standstill
threes.
You have
one incredible skill. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'd listen there. I just looked at Mike and Breen after the game. I'm like, they're going to be a problem. And I don't know who beats them. You know, the Celtics got 52 points in the paint, you know, outscored them by 20 in that regard. You know, do you see a weakness somebody could exploit, Zach?
No weakness that somebody could exploit. You know, they're deep, like they're deep. And again, Shamet will be a big part of their team. Although I think the lineup they started last night is going to be their starting lineup, even when everyone is healthy. But some of their players against playoff defenses, you're throwing like your Jamichael Greens and your Harklesses and your Magruders, who maybe won't be in the rotation, are going to have a hard time.
If the ball finds those names, do you trust them to make the shots Patrick Beverley made last night?
And by the way, Patrick Beverley had not been making
last night. We talked about how brutal he had been. In fact, Mike Breen just said, hey, this is what he had done. It was pretty telling. I love Patrick Beverley. My point was I felt like I had undersold him relative to Marcus Smart a season ago. But Yeah, I mean, listen, that was just so much fun. And I, even in the first half, which was, you know, we were comparing it to a 1980s game with in terms of the scoring, but they were two defensive-minded teams who were contesting shots and doing some stuff. It'll be so fun to see the Clippers, depending on, you know, how much time they get together and how much run and burn they have, what they look like 8 weeks from now.
Yeah, it's funny. I think last night, they'll look better. Chemistry will help, but I think they're kind of a ready-made team. Like, they could use, if you're asking me, like, ideally, what could they get? I think one more ball handler, just like a bench kind of like scorer ball handler guy who can loosen up the defense, maybe, but I think their ball handling is almost okay. And if Beverly's going to have to make shots, but I hope Beverly didn't hear you guys dogging him because he's just like in the locker room after games. This is the second time this has happened.
I watched the video of it this morning. Well, I was dying laughing.
Sometimes he's not even doing interviews. Like the last time I was here, I go in the locker room after a game and I'm talking to people and Beverly's interview's over. He's just at his stall going, compare my game to Matthew Dellavedova. I was like, Pat, who are you? Is he talking to me? I don't think I compared his game. There was nobody around him. He was just muttering.
He's a character. You had to see the reaction of George Sedano last night in the post game because, he finishes the question and then turns quickly on George and compliments his outfit. I don't remember exactly the words he used, but I almost fell off my chair laughing. Listen, I love characters. I love guys that have that edge and, you know, are not shy about using that edge. So good for Pat. Good for Pat. He's fun to watch.
Yeah, I picked them to win the championship before the season. It's going to be, the playoffs are going to be a lot of fun. I mean, all of these teams in the West are really good. The Lakers are 12-2.
Yes.
Denver, for all the, you know, Jokic came in overweight. They're winning games. Utah's 9-5, has not found their rhythm on offense at all.
Joe Ingles has not played anywhere close to what he's capable of playing. And, I think that's the extraordinary thing about Utah is they haven't found themselves at all offensively. I don't know that that's atypical of a Quinn Snyder coach team. I feel as though the defense is always in place early and somehow they figure it out offensively eventually. I mean, think last year they're open jump shots away from doing better stuff.
So let's go back to Boston because it is, I mean, everyone is going to pin it on the locker room being a happier place because Kyrie's gone. And I think that's just accurate.
Sure.
The surface level stats suggest what they're doing offensively is not that different, but I do think it is different. I'm curious to see what else you see on the floor with them.
Well, I thought that they would miss tremendously Gordon Hayward's playmaking abilities, his ability to touch the paint and have vision and do the things that made him an all-star in Utah. And I was really struck when I read an interview where Jaylen Brown was asked, do you need to raise your scoring level? And he said, I don't think that's what we'll miss. And he essentially said, we will miss Gordon's playmaking, and it's our responsibility to fill in. And I just thought it was such a mature thought as opposed to somebody saying, I'm going to take, you know, however many more shots. It's striking when you look at the distribution of usage amongst the group because it is so equal opportunity.
Democratic. I don't think they have anyone averaging 5 assists a game.
No, and it was really like when you said the in terms of the number of minutes.
Time of possession.
I was blown away by that. It's funny. I didn't pick it up at the time, but I remember hearing Brian Scalabrine, who obviously big part of the Celtics coverage early in the year, talking about, I was in Danny Ainge's living room and saying there was no way you could keep Aaron Baines and sign Kemba. And Danny's like, no, you know, we would have done it. Do you think they are just that? And Aaron is unique in terms of, you know, Boston always preaches such a simple thing, but show big.
Mm-hmm.
As you're coming up the floor, show big. And then the kind of talking and communicating Aaron does as people are, you know, getting into their sets and running their options. And he's constantly, I mean, are they that piece away? What do you make of the Celtics sort of, you know, starting Tice, who I think has been pretty good.
Tice has been great for them.
He's been real. He's surprised.
And by the way,
I always liked him and thought he was good. He's been better than I thought.
And good on Brad. I think Kanter's injury was a blessing in disguise, because I think I don't think they should start Kanter. Yeah. I think he's better as a bench scorer.
Yes.
Tice does more of what they need offensively, because honestly, part of what I think is different is I think even if Kemba has the ball a lot, I do think he goes north-south more directly than Kyrie. He doesn't dance like Kyrie does.
No doubt.
And that means he gets off of it earlier when he needs to get off of it earlier. And I think the second thing is they replaced Marcus Morris, who's a little bit of a hog and likes to hold the ball, and Al Horford, who is not a hog at all but has the ball a lot, with one of their wings who is now starting.
Yes.
And a center who's like, I'm cool never touching the ball. Like, no, all I'll correct. Do is rim run. I'll just rim run. Like, Al was
and took 1-3 last night.
Yeah.
And it was wide open.
And Al will sometimes roll to the rim, but he likes to pop. He'll do a little, but like, all they got now is Kanter and rim runners.
Yes.
Like, Tice is going to run to the rim. Robert Williams is going to break the rim.
Yes.
And so I think having Morris's usage gone and redistributed amongst those wings, and having a center who uses the ball less, I think that's helped everyone feel like we're getting it enough. Even if the offense looks similar, we're getting enough. To your question, my challenge with them is I don't know who the guy is, because if you're talking – the names that are always linked to them for big men are like Capella and Steven Adams and Kevin Love, and – the only way Boston can trade for one of those guys is to trade out of their core 5 or 6 wing guys. And
you do it?
And truthfully, given the play they're getting from Tice and Williams, Robert Williams
he's getting there.
He's got a little feel too. A little passing.
Yeah, he's getting touch. There. He's getting there. The question is, you know, it reminds me a little of Furkan Korkmaz, where he has the game winner and he certainly is getting confident as he gets minutes. That doesn't mean that in the crucible of those moments that you've built up enough equity in your mind and with your teammates that you can deliver. And I'm really curious about that with Robert Williams, because I do feel like he's coming and he's improving. And obviously repetition is what gets people there.
It's interesting you mention that, because that what you just said reminds me of the Raptors acquiring Marc Gasol last year, because the Raptors were rolling and their center rotation was Valanciunas and Ibaka.
That's
or Ibaka
right.
and Valanciunas, whatever. Yeah. And it didn't seem like they had some urgent need for an upgraded center. But Masai Ujiri was like,
they see it.
These
executives and these coaches, they know, they see it ahead of time and they're like, that's not going to work.
But you know what
then,
he saw?
Yeah.
He saw when gets a little crazy in the playoffs and it's a frenzy and the crowd's going nuts and we're playing a great defensive team, we need a big man release valve who can catch the ball at the foul line and settle us down.
Yes.
And like, everyone knows to cut. It's just going to be calm and Mark will make the right reads. And that was so dead right.
Yes.
And I did not see it and they saw it.
Yes.
What you just said reminded me of that. So my thing is, I don't think any of those big names are coming for the reasons I said. I do think Boston will look for, and maybe we'll find, their version of either, you want to use Gasol, that might be a little too big, of Ilyasova and Bellinelli for Philly 2 years
ago. Yeah, sure.
Some fringe move that, because of who the player is and how he fits, has an outsized impact compared to his rep. I don't know who that is, though.
That's an interesting sentiment. I really like Boston. I like how intelligently they switch. I like that Drew Hanlon basically said to Jason Tatum, you need to take 6 threes and you need to get to 6 free throw attempts per game and you're going to go from 15 to 20 and you'll be an all-star. And it goes to how the game is played. Can I ask you an aside about
this is why I like having you on. You take it and you go.
Well,
ask me questions.
I prefer to ask than be asked questions, but I am curious. I saw a comment about from Powell, and it's really a silly supposition to throw it out there, but did you have any reaction to when he said about the way the game is played and the aesthetics and the beauty of it is gone?
What do you say?
Oh,
too many threes, basically.
Yeah, and you know, in this day and age, you know, shots that are taken, you know, before a pass is made or before 5 seconds, he goes, you would have been pulled, and it just, you know, feel like you've almost. And I don't want to put words in his mouth, but you've lost the beauty of the game. And I feel so lucky to be courtside and calling these games that I don't really see it through that prism, because we are, you know, treated nightly to the best basketball players in the world, but I don't know if the fans, you know, care or
well,
watch.
Ratings are down.
Well, and that was my point, you know, where the ratings are down, and the ratings are not just down, Zach. They're down across every single demographic. Obviously, the coveted 18 to 34 year old, but it spans much greater than that. And then I saw a note about, you know, 500,000 people viewed the highlights of one particular game, just the highlights, on YouTube. 500,000 people. And then I go to Cassidy Hubbard's Twitter show pregame during the NBA Finals, and they were getting over 1 million viewers, yep. You know, with Kendrick Perkins. And, you know, that's a great tandem because, you know, Cassidy's young and hip and just has a great feel and so passionate about the league, and Kendrick will say a lot of things. I just... He will say a lot of things, but it just, it's fascinating me. It's, I guess, I think like most things in life, the NBA and its viewership is changing at light speed.
So yesterday John Hollinger wrote a piece for, our old colleague John Hollinger wrote a piece for The Athletic proposing a ban on three shot fouls. That if you get fouled shooting a three, you should get two foul shots. That's it. And I like that idea. And I sympathize with what Powell is saying, although I think the game looks good now, there are, let's say, 10 shots a game. The one that's sticking out is from a Minnesota game like two or 3 days ago I was watching. Robert Covington got the ball on the wing on a one-on-two fast break. Nobody was with him. Defender was actually kind of like closer than we are now.
Yeah.
And he was just jacked up a three, and I was like, that sucked. I kind of wanted to see Carl Anthony Towns maybe
yes,
get the ball. And there's like
yes.
10 of those a game. And
sure.
the connection with Hollinger's thing is, and Kirk Goldsberry's book, Sprawl Ball, which you should all buy, gets into this too, is the math is so overwhelming. Three is worth so much more than two.
Yes.
That this is not going to stop.
No.
Unless the NBA changes a rule.
Yes.
Some rule. So John Hollinger's proposal would be one such rule. Because the leg kicking and the flailing
sure.
to get three foul shots is more valuable than a dunk.
Yeah.
It is a more valuable thing to get than a dunk. Kirk Goldsberry in his book proposed a number of things. I mean, everyone's going to propose no more corner threes, move the line back, whatever. My favorite proposal he made was shrink the lane again. Narrow the lane again so post-up guys can get back closer to the rim and they're not posting up 15 feet from the rim. Mm-hmm. We've made all of these changes to benefit three-point shooters or offensive players, but really it just comes down to three is 50% more than two.
Yeah.
And the game is going to continue to trend in a direction of chasing that 50% until the rules are changed. And I do think it's time for the NBA to look at those Robert Covington shots and think, have we gotten a little too out of balance? Now, I don't want to be old man yelling at cloud here because right. I do like the
yeah.
game,
yeah.
but I think it's a legitimate concern.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. You know, one thing, we were meeting with Doc pregame yesterday and he was telling us, and I can't remember why we went down this path. We probably were talking about, you know, the number of threes taken, but one interesting thing Doc had said to us was, and I think Mike talked about this on the air last night, was essentially he has twice in practice this year basically said no threes. Just for X number of possessions, we're going no threes. And he said it's an amazing thing to watch guys start sprinting to the rim again in transition. And he said I said, well, what's the purpose of that? And he said to foster ball movement. And he said the feel of the game changes almost instantly. It's just interesting. Back to Boston. I love them.
They're tough.
They're tough.
Those are two grimy teams last
yeah,
night.
Yeah, grimy is a great word. Yes.
They make you earn it. And Boston, they're good. They're better than I didn't think they would be this good.
Yeah,
I really
me
didn't.
Me neither. I'm so happy for Daniel Theis because I know he's a hard worker and, you know, well liked and just to, you know, to watch him live and see him communicate and, he is exceptional and maybe they're best at getting them out of bad situations defensively. So.
Kemba's also defending his ass off this year.
Really,
he's flying around.
He really
one
is.
One last Boston thing because yeah. we started with him. Let's finish with him. I don't know that I've ever been more wrong about a player than Marcus Smart. His first 2 years in the league, I would watch the Celtics in the playoffs, and nobody would guard him. He'd have 20 feet of space, and he would miss and miss and miss. And I said, look, I see all the special stuff he does on defense. I see the offensive rebounds where he flies in, and it's so demoralizing for the defense when he does that. It's just not going to matter if he can't shoot. And I was wrong on two fronts. Number one, now he can shoot.
He can shoot.
Number two, it mattered anyway because he's just so damn good at the stuff that he's good at. I've become like a Marcus Smart true believer.
Yeah.
The guy is a stud. He's a great presence in their locker room. He's just a flat-out, really good NBA player.
I agree. And as Jay Larinaga, and I have this quote, it's so good, and I won't get it all, but he talks about what a selfless human being he is and how pure of heart he is. And I just thought, wow, pure of heart, that's a statement about a character that goes beyond just a surface-level observation. And, yeah, listen, I like that team. I like watching them. I like the feel of them, and I like Jaylen Brown. I'm a Jaylen Brown fan, and I think he's coming. Can I give you one more question? Because I kind of put Mike in a bad spot in a telecast just because.
You spent half of these podcasts apologizing for things that nobody even registered. No one thinks any of these things happened.
Well, so I asked Mike, and I liked my question to Mike Breen, but I didn't like when I asked it, because the game was so good. I should have just let the game do the talking. But I did say, of Brown and Tatum, do you think one has a higher ceiling than the other? Do you think one has a higher ceiling than the other?
It's an interesting question. I wrote a big story on Jaylen Brown a couple of years ago for this very reason, because I think defensively he has a chance to be special.
Me too.
That I think it's a fair question, but I do think Tatum has a higher ceiling because he has a chance to be a number one scorer. Play make much, and that's whoever fills that hole is going to be the one that makes the leap. But I also think Tatum has become a very underrated defensive player and a good defensive player.
Oh, look at their numbers. If you go on and see the five best guys in terms of field goal percentage against them individually as defenders, they're both top five. And they're right there with Giannis.
And if Tatum is a good defender, and I think he is, I think that's legit, then I think his ceiling is higher.
Yeah.
We have to do a little bit on the other big story the biggest story from the last 2 weeks in the NBA, not the biggest, but one of them, is the complete collapse of the San Antonio Spurs, who are 5-10. I think they're 27th in defense or something horrible, 25th, something like that.
They were 29th at one point, so they've moved up.
They're minus a lot with their two alleged stars on the floor together. Last time I checked, it was like minus 6 per 100 possessions. Rarely does a team disappoint like this, and it's surprising. I'm floored. They won 48 games last year. They almost won a playoff series. They got DeJounte Murray back. Now, I realize they lost Bertans because of the Marcus Morris fiasco, but there is no indicator to me that, like, this team would just be bad. What is happening?
It's not only that they're 5-10, because a season ago, I believe they were several games under 500 in early December, if I'm not mistaken.
You're correct.
Okay. And then in, the latter stages of December, they righted the ship defensively, and I had them early, and LaMarcus wasn't playing well at the time, and I said to Pop, I mean, is there something here? Is this just a guy who hasn't caught his rhythm? He goes, I'm hoping he hasn't caught his rhythm, and obviously he hadn't. But that's not the case. DeMar and LaMarcus are basically providing what they were providing a season ago. One thing I'm curious about, and I had the Spurs last year, and DeMar had reverted. I don't remember. I think did he shoot 32% in his final year from three when the Toronto Raptors obviously made him shoot them?
Yeah, and it's very clear that that's really what happened. They forced him.
They must have, because so then I get him last year, and I had him early, and then I had him a little bit later because I didn't ask the question the first time around about DeMar not shooting threes. But now once, you get 20, 25 games, and I remember going up to Chip England in a pregame, and I said, can I ask a question? I said, I was encouraged by DeMar, three-point shooting in Toronto because I think he's capable. Like, I mean, the guy could score in his sleep. And all players revert to what's comfortable. But it looked to me like he was getting comfortable with the three in Toronto. And I'm like, this is necessary. This is part of the evolution of your game and to play in today's NBA. But he stopped. And I went up to Chip England. I don't remember what time of year it was. But I said, can I ask a question? Do you guys encourage, discourage, have a discussion, don't have a discussion? And he was like, we allow our players to play to their strengths. And he goes, if DeMar's comfortable there. And so that was my answer. So I'm not putting everything on DeMar. I just, as a broader based observation, I almost would have liked to have seen him continue in that. Here's what I know. they've survived in an atypical fashion the last couple of years because of the strengths of their two superstars. But they survived on the fundamental principles of we're going to be very competitive with great effort, connected effort, and we're not going to foul on the defensive end. Right? And so then you finish the possession with a rebound and you go your other way. And then you keep your turnovers low and, you know, you're navigating some of your lack of shooting by doing those things. And I always go back to this one comment Jeff Van Gundy made to me. He said, if you play very sound defense, give up one contested shot, finish a defensive possession with a rebound, and don't turn it over on the other end, I don't care what level of basketball you're talking about, you're going to give yourself a chance to win. I would be interested to ask Jeff the same question as we watch the league tilt more and more toward what you're talking about, the analytics and the value of the three-point shot and how the game is played. And I will ask him the next time I see him, is that still the case?
Interesting. They did play to the strengths of their stars and survive that way. Their offense is still top 10. Offense is not why they're is not why they're losing.
They gave up 138 points to Washington.
Bad teams.
They've lost to
Atlanta.
They're losing to bad teams. It's not like they had a soft spot in their schedule. What happens when they hit the rough patch?
Well, they won last year primarily, well, not primarily, with a dynamite bench. Yeah. Their bench killed people. Bertans is gone.
That's right.
Derek White. Something's just not happening with Derek White. Now he's got some sort of injury. I think a toe, maybe, or a heel, or a shin, or something, some leg part. So maybe
and they
that
start Patty Mills.
Now they totally changed.
So if you're
their...
playing Patty Mills and Bryn, I mean, I like both guys. Tough, gritty, going to work their backside off on the defensive end. But if you're playing Patty, Bryn, DeMar on the defensive end of the floor,
you got no shot. And I think if you look at the indicators of their defense, their fundamental indicators are healthy. Like, they're allowing the right kinds of shots. Ironically, they're allowing the same kind of shots they take on offense.
Yeah.
They're rebounding free throws, all the stuff you're talking about. They're still doing most of that. Teams are just shooting the hell out of it against them. So here I have it somewhere. They are allowing 68% shooting at the rim. That's last. They are allowing 39% shooting on threes. That's 27th.
Oof.
They are allowing 44% shooting on mid-range shots. That's 25th. And I think it's just – they're just a little small and soft. I don't mean soft in some sort of like, you know, they're like the way that people use soft to insult.
I think
shooters drive into them or rise up with in traffic and they're like, oh, I'm kind of unfettered. Like, I'm not bothered by anything here. Aldridge looks to me like he's lost a step defensively, from even just last year. And DeRozan, I mean, for all the attention on his shot selection, and it's ridiculous he's taken four threes this year. It's ridiculous that the Spurs have let this happen. Defense is why he is not as good as his reputation. If you just watch him close out on people
if he gets momentarily hung up on a screen,
does he continue to battle?
You know?
And he gets blown by all the time.
Yeah.
And there's been some communication mistakes that I think are uncharacteristic of the Spurs, but they're losing because their defense stinks. I mean, and I don't think this shooting, now some of that is luck, right? If teams are just killing you, a little bit of it is luck, but I don't watch them and think it's just bad luck.
Not seeing a turnaround similar to last season.
I'm not giving up on the Spurs. Let me make that clear for the San Antonio people.
No, it's like you can. I mean, historically, it would be impossible. Until they don't make the playoffs, I'm not giving up on them.
They have, again, if White's healthy, if he comes back fast, Murray looks good. He's not shooting as much as I would like, but if the mid-ranger that was so ballyhooed going into last season has not happened, maybe a little bit. They have good players. Pop is obviously as good as it gets. They have a history of improving as the season goes along, as you just said.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the West, it's not going to take 48 wins to get into the playoffs.
The bottom of the West is going to give you a window to go through a stretch like they're going through and still find a way to get in. I'm very curious about them. I really am. I am intrigued by DeJounte Murray's future. I want to see DeJounte Murray 2 or 3 years from now. You know, just you look at the menace he could be on the defensive end of the floor. you're learning the toughest position in the game. You've got to be able to cycle through an awful lot of coverages quickly, and so I'm curious. I'll be curious about them. It would be nice if they could keep their health together at some point, regardless of whether they're in the playoffs or out, but to give Derek White and DeJounte an opportunity to grow through a consistent period where they're able to get to the floor. That's really what I want to see.
Again, I'm not giving up on them. They started slow last year. I don't ever remember alarm bells like this going off where they're just losing to bad teams and getting blown off the floor on defense.
Right. They normally beat who they're supposed to beat. Yeah, that's the truth.
It hasn't been like this. Okay, Doris, you got to go. I always appreciate you you make it any time for this stupid podcast.
Get out of here. I enjoy these discussions.
We'll do the finals again.
Okay, sounds good.
I won't bother you until then. Doris Burke, you're a legend. Thank you. We're switching gears. Doris is gone, off to live it up in L.A., hopefully. And in the door, in her chair, because we just had to do this, is Kevin Arnovitz, who just wrote a riveting piece that was really just like a movie about Jeff David, a former Kings chief revenue officer.
That's right.
And former Heat, but didn't really get started at the Heat. Who stole how much money?
$13 million.
$13 million. And how did he do it?
Wow. Funny story. So sponsorships. It's like we talk about front office people. We talk about the basketball ops people a lot here. There's this entire parallel universe over in every NBA team, which is the business ops people. These are the people that often the basketball ops people don't like, but, it's neither here nor there. So he was just in charge of sponsorship. So all that stuff, right? Like the names that are on the arena, that sideline score table advertising you see, he was in charge of selling all that stuff. And the way he did it is Golden One. We know the Golden One Center. There might even be playoff games sometime soon at the Golden One Center, if the Kings are fortunate. And, he put together that deal. He also put together the deal for their training facility, which is the Kaiser Permanente training facility. All these teams have like sponsors for their training facilities. And in the process of putting together the big title sponsorship or the naming rights sponsorship deal, what he did was he took a little for himself. He, after they came to a 20-year, $110 million agreement with Golden One, sometime after finalizing the deal, while the Kings were still putting the last touches on their arena, he went back to Golden One and said, hey, you know, we had had previous discussions about maybe you'd give us more money up front because we have this expensive arena we're building. Would you still consider that? And Golden One, who was so thrilled, I mean, Golden One, this is not American Airlines. This is not Toyota. I mean, it's a big deal for a credit union to
have
a sponsorship on an arena, on an NBA arena. They said, sure, we can get you $9 million. Absolutely. And so what Jeff David did was, he created a separate entity that sounds just like the Sacramento Kings. It's called Sacramento Sports Partners.
Reasonable. I believe it.
Yeah, they all have these subsidiaries.
Here's some money.
And Golden One, thinking they were, giving an advance to the Kings so that they could help finish the arena, instead paid $9 million to an entity that was owned by this guy. He did it again in a somewhat different fashion with Kaiser Permanente, saying, hey, rather than give us these little cost of living or sort of inflationary increases in your annual payment for sponsorship every year, why don't you just give us a lump sum now? We'll do away with all that inflationary thing. And that was $4.4 million.
So 13.4, boom, done. It's just his money now. Well, not anymore. So you go through, I don't want to spoil the story because people need to sit down. It's a New Yorker story. It's a New Yorker crime story. People need just to sit down and read it. Set aside however long it takes. So you go through the process of the Kings catching him. And the hero of that is an HR woman, whose name I'm Stacy something.
Stacy Wegson.
Who does a lot of detective work, and you tick-tock through that and every discovery and the adrenaline going through. So you have the Kings. You have the sponsors who get duped. They don't talk to you for the story.
No.
You have the HR person does talk to you, I think. You interview the guy himself in
yes.
prison. First prison interview of all time?
No, not in prison. Before he goes to prison.
Oh, before.
He had to report in late August, and I saw him in right after July 4th.
You have the most, in 10 years, the one thing I'll remember from that story, if I hope I remember more, but if there is just one, it will be the scene in his house when his family discovers what has happened, and in particular, his wife. Did you talk to her?
I was able to talk to many of the people involved. I mean, I did speak to the in-laws.
Who come to counsel and help them when they realize that the life of this family is now falling apart.
Right. And by the way, still believe in Jeff David, the man who
I was going to ask you, they appear to still be married.
No, it's one of what I think one of the things that first drew me to the story, just kind of at the very beginning, is that, I mean, this is a guy who, yes, maybe had some detractors, and he had, you know, he was sort of bro-y in his personality, but a guy who was by and large really well respected in the NBA. If you asked a bunch of NBA team CEOs, hey, give me the short list of people who are going to be NBA team presidents in the next 10 years, give me the rising class, this guy's name would be on it, right? Like, they were both current and former Kings employees who were like, you know, you have to appreciate what a good force of energy he was in the office. I had one person tell me, if you lined up 100 Kings employees in order of likelihood that they would steal $13.5 million from, sponsors, he would be at the very end of the line.
Wow.
Right? So, he was the consummate soccer dad. You know, I actually watched him parent. I mean, he's
yeah,
fantastic
with
kids.
You have a
kids.
Scene with him, with his family.
Right. And so I think that was sort of, you know, why do people do things? You know, what possesses, especially the cost-benefit analysis. I mean, I think the thing that I got really into in the course of the story was, like, so how much money would you risk your freedom for, right? Like, if you have a moral calculus, you just don't believe in stealing, right? Like, I'm not somebody who's going to go steal from my employer because I just don't believe. I mean, it's not what you do. There's a compact and you don't break it. But if you are going to risk your freedom, how much would it take? And I think that was sort of what was interesting is this is a guy who, you know, didn't have an expensive drug habit or a gambling habit. He wasn't living extravagantly. They had a nice home that was befitting of a professional couple in town in Land Park neighborhood of Sacramento. But he put a lot at risk. This is a guy with three young children. This is a guy with a family that loves him. And he just basically, I mean, put everything at risk to embezzle this money, to invest it into beach homes that he would then flip.
Well, one reason you do it, I would imagine, is you don't think it's a risk. You don't think you're going to get caught.
He came really close to not getting caught. I mean, I think that's what made, you know, Stacey Wegzin truly a hero in the sense that I think he was scot-free until, I would say, 2026. That was the first year that there would be a discrepancy between the amount of money the Kings were expecting and the amount of money Golden won by virtue of the revised contract that they amended because they would give less later on the back end, and that he would have to account for it. And he had this entire plan where, hey, I was going to set up an account, Golden won. It's like if I bought you a concert ticket from Venmo, $150, and you paid me back and you gave me a $100 Venmo and a $50 Venmo. I'd be like, why the hell is Zach giving me in two payments? Right. But hey, it's $150. It's all there. That's good.
What's so riveting about part of the scene where the in-laws are there, husband and wife are there, distraught. Well, she's distraught that everything is crashing down. Is he, according to your reporting and quotes in the story, essentially doesn't realize that it's a big deal and is kind of like, I can just pay everybody back and then everything goes away. That's incredible. And you reconstruct that moment so beautiful, or those conversations so beautifully. Like, are they still apoplectic? Does he now realize that it was a big deal?
I mean, the interesting thing about Jeff David is I still think he sees it essentially as an unauthorized loan. I still think he, so long as he didn't lose the money, hey, everybody was going to be made whole again. I was going to get everybody their money back. I was going to pay this back. Well, whether or not you believe that or not, and I don't think there's a lot of evidence. And, you know, in talking to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I got a chance to interview them and have conversations, it's just so rare. I was going to give it back, apparently, as sort of, when you talk to white crime prosecutors, they're like, yeah, he was going to give it back. But I think that was sort of what's weird is when he was talking to his in-laws, and I think that's where they kind of became incredulous. But even to this day, you know, David feels like he has a career after he gets out, which will probably be in about 5 more years. You know, he sees a scenario where, yeah, sure, I could consult professional sports teams, you know, especially ones that are sort of new in the sponsorship game. Hey, if so-and-so company presents, hey, we want to get into business with your team and you're the team, you know, hey, he'd be the guy who looks over the structure of the deal and makes sure that it's favorable for your terms. And I kind of asked him, I go, would anybody in sports touch you with a 10-foot pole? And, you know, I mean, he is optimistic to believe that, yeah, sure, you know, I've shown a capacity to do this job and I'll do it again. Maybe I won't be on the letterhead, but that's sort of the thing. He's a very, very normal guy in every conventional sense. Yet there are these blind spots. Like, I think he certainly has expressed remorse, but I still think that, I mean, he said to me, I never thought of this as my money.
That's just bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. Who was the hardest person for you to get to sit down with you, whether it was on the record or just for background?
It was Jeff David.
Who was the hardest? Other than him, who was the hardest? What made him agree to do it in the end? Did you just have so much and you just said, look, I want to hear your side yeah. or your, tell me what the human side of this has been for your family?
I just wanted that piece. I mean, I think there's always this danger where you don't want to be apologizing for a criminal. I mean, what he did was wrong, and I believe in objective truth. I think there is such a thing as right and wrong, and what he did was wrong. So you don't want to excuse it, but you do want to explain it, right? Like, I wanted to understand, like, I really want to know why, like, what he thought. I wanted to know what his rationale was. I wanted to know, you know, the moment he decided to do this. I mean, there was this early, I mean, the thing that I was able to produce that wasn't in the official, indictment or information, as it were, was he had skimmed off $30,000 earlier in his career with the Kings, like back when they were at Arco playing up in the Potomac and they were in that rickety old arena. He first got his first taste of deception with the Kings was, if he'd get an incoming call from a local company that wanted to buy a little sideline signage, what he would, rather than kind of run it through the official accounting process, would he be like, we'll hook you up for this homestand or whatever it was. You know, $9,500 and you get a few signs in the second quarter against Indiana, whatever it is. And rather than invoicing the company to pay the Kings official account, he had that Sacramento Sports Partnership, entity that he had set up and he just invoiced them to make the bill payable to his entity. So he did this 3 times, totaling $30,000. That hadn't been previously reported. But I just kind of wanted to know, and he never really offered a satisfactory answer. And I don't know that he even knows. I mean, at one point I asked him, he's like, you know, curiosity, stupidity. And I think that was the most interesting thing is like, why do you do it? And, you know, one thing that started to dawn on me as you really get into this is just like, okay, you're Jeff David. You're the chief revenue officer of the Sacramento Kings. You make $360,000 a year plus bonuses by any standard. That is, you're butting up against the 1%. You might not be there.
So here's what I thought as a writer was very interesting. You have all this information. You have a million ways to organize a story. You have a million ways to end it.
It was organized a million different ways along the way, by the way.
But here's how you end it. I'm going to read how you end it because it doesn't really give anything away. People will still read the story. You have a scene. You describe the most exclusive lounge at the Golden One Center where all the big wigs, you know, meet to watch the game or mingle. And so David was a fixture on the event level too. And even though he was earning $360,000 per year plus bonuses, just about everyone in here made more than he did. Jeff David was awash in wealth, yet in this rarefied air, he was the pauper. End of story. How did you settle on that? How many other ways did you end the story? Or did you always know you wanted to end it there? And is that you essentially pitching the theory, that's why he did it? He felt that he was outclassed even though he was making so much money in his day-to-day job.
I mean, getting at motivation was so important for all the editors and for me too, right? And we don't really know for sure. And we don't know exactly why he did it. I mean, I think there was a part of him that wanted some action of his own. You know, you work for a company, you put together a $120 million deal. It's not your deal. It's Vivek's deal. It's the partner's deal. It's the King's deal. You know, so I think there was a part of him who wanted his own action. I think there was part of him that you know, as crazy as it sounds, you know, his wife, who's just among the more, you know, just a really pleasant person, but, you know, didn't grow up with great means. I think there was always a sense that he wanted to provide. He wanted to, they worried a lot about money, even though they were making good money. And so I think there was a part of it that was about that. But I think, to me, I just kept coming back to the NBA, even since you and I have been covering it. Like, it's a different level of wealth. We've gone from, you know, the Miller family and the Buss family and Herb Cole to hedge fund guy and just obscene, like $8 billion of revenue. I mean, even since you and I have been covering this game.
Absolutely.
Like, revenue's almost, it's tripled.
Yep.
You know, it's so much wealth. So here's this guy. He's doing the schmooze thing every single night, at the game. And who is he surrounded by? An owner who's worth hundreds of millions, minority owners who are worth, in some cases, hundreds of millions. Certainly even the small fry minority owners are worth tens of millions, right? DeMarcus Cousins is making an excess of $20 million a year. The ninth, tenth, and eleventh man on the team is making probably 10 times what Jeff Davis is making. There's a coach who is almost his exact age to the year at that time, making 10 times what he makes. The lobbyists from Sacramento down the street at the Capitol. I mean, Sacramento's this weird city. It's, you know, Phil Jackson calls it a cowtown. You know what? It's the capital city of the fifth largest economy in the world. And, you know, you go into the Lex.
That means big people are going to be there all the time.
Every day. Especially a new arena. So you've got these big mucky muck lobbyists. You've got these real estate developers. And I just wonder, and, you know, and that was to me what I kept coming back to is everyone else has more. And do I know for certain that that was the, that what drove him? I don't think he felt deprived, but he certainly was running in a world where there was just what he was essentially subsisting on. In his eyes, was just so much less than everybody else.
Did you know you wanted to end the story that way almost from the beginning?
No, we almost started the story with that scene. I love that scene. I just think there's, you know, it's funny. Do you, is that a great, because on one hand, it's a, we love it as a kicker, but it's also could have been a really interesting introduction too. I mean, we could have started right there. This is his world, right?
It caught me by surprise when I read it in a good way. Like, oh, that's how we decided to end the story, but it ended like a punch to the stomach. The word pauper hit me like, ooh, that's really what he was. That's probably what he felt. Who were you? How hard was it to get the Kings, to get Stacey to talk?
Not terribly hard. I mean, I think I've done some work on the Kings. And
yeah.
I mean, I think I'd like to believe and we'd have to ask them that I established some trust over the years. I mean, I've been rough on them, and I also wrote a piece about their real estate efforts, which have been pretty successful in Sacramento. They run a pretty good business ops situation there. But I think, you know, I think it was an organization that felt like, you know, this guy had wronged them and really hadn't been covered. I mean, I think that's the other thing. It's gotten in the SACB's done some work on it, and there's some local news stuff, but there really hasn't been, it's kind of gone. It went undetected. Like, I was kind of, there was that moment where, is anyone else doing this? No one else is doing this. And I kind of kept pursuing it and thinking that, you know, perhaps there'd be a bunch of people in the story, but I got lucky in that respect. And, so she was able, I mean, I think everybody was a little nervous. And I think, you know, what's funny. We spend so much of our time talking to players, coaches, and execs. It's nice talking to non-famous people.
It really is.
You know what, Zach? I got to tell you, I'm looking for more stories. I mean, no disrespect to NBA players, coaches, and executives whose conversation, I love talking to those people, but you know, can I make a request? Can I beg? Can I plead 5 minutes? Just please, you know, and
hey,
and
I started on the crime and court beat at a newspaper. Like these stories are everywhere. Yeah. I mean, maybe not to this magnitude in this kind of setting, but like these are, there's a reason why every show on television is about crime. I mean, these are human dramas with characters that are motivated by weird things and do crazy stuff, and the stories are gutting and interesting.
It's like, it's so different than doing a feature on basketball, because in some ways sports and crime are two really interesting laboratories for, because what we do is like in on our best days we get it human motivation, right? We get it what makes people tick, and sports and competition is a great place to examine that, and that's what we do most of the time. But crime is an entirely different venue where you get to examine that. And that was what was just so fun for me.
What was the conversation where you felt the most, I don't, maybe you never felt uneasy or nervous, or either that or the conversation where you're having it and you're like, this is the one, this is going to make the story. I don't know if there was a moment interview, because sometimes when you're doing crime stories, like, as a reporter, you get nervous. Like, these are really uncomfortable conversations. So I don't know. Was there one like that?
I think talking to his in-laws, who are supportive and are just such fundamentally decent people. I mean, I try to remain objective about this stuff, but they are objectively decent people. And kind of hearing the testimonials of, you know, what the family went through, and watching Jeff that night. Here they are moving into this gorgeous new house in Miami. I mean, look, what an upgrade in many respects. I mean, the Sacramento Kings, the Miami Heat, is considered a gold standard organization and largely a reflection of the fact that he's very well thought of in this space. I mean, if you want a person to do sponsorship for your NBA franchise, Jeff Davis is the name you call, right? And I mean, this is the next chapter in their family's life. The in-laws fly in to take care of the kids because moving into a new house is really hectic, and they're cable guys and they're movers coming in and out. And then it's just, they're the most lovely, just kind couple, but listening to them offer the testimonial of, you know, what the family went through, and just sort of his having to confront his wife, who's just, you know, and it seems like an exceptionally pleasant person, and just having to break it to them, this is all really a farce. This beachfront real estate property partnership you thought you were just a part of was actually my own personal endeavor, where I was funneling $13.5 million.
Have you heard from the family or from him since the story was published?
I have not.
Wow. I thought maybe you would.
I thought I maybe would too.
Have you kept in touch with him since he's gone to prison?
No, I have not. I mean, he reported, a little less than 3 months ago.
Did you interview the FBI agent? I believe you did, right?
Yeah, I was able to interview the lead FBI investigator in the case.
That's cool.
Yeah, that was my favorite conversation.
Really? Why? Just because it's a peek into this?
Cause I think investigating white collar crimes with an FBI badge is a really interesting job.
Yeah.
Like he gets such an interesting, bird's eye view to the human condition.
Did he find this case interesting, or did he find it like, yeah, I deal with this kind of stuff all the time?
You know, it's funny. I mean, he wasn't dismissive or whatever, but I get the sense like, yeah, this is what he does, right? Like scams that we find just fascinating with novelty, because by and large we walk through life and we don't really meet many of these people, right? I mean, we just kind of hang out with who we hang out with, and this guy's peers, or not peers, but the people he interacts with every single day, are people just ripping people off.
What is the thing that got cut that broke your heart to cut it, if anything? Is there a detail? Is there a quote? Is there something that
so in a weird way, all right, because I'm a total weirdo. So Stacey Wegzin, when she was doing all this, you fall in love with characters, even though they're real people, but they're still characters in a novel you're reading and loving. And so Stacey Wegzin is just, I think we don't get to cover a lot of people like Stacey, right? She's a professional. She is in her 40s and she is a working mom. And on the week that she's dove headfirst into this, like staying up at her kitchen table at 3 a.m, her dog Roxy was dying.
That's not in the story, I believe.
No, Roxy's not. And so I'm joking, because in the weirdo world that are writing features, there's always the one detail that frankly doesn't make or break the story, but you get so attached to, just because for whatever reason it becomes this avatar for something bigger. And it was just like, we had to cut Roxy. I mean, the piece was long and like the editors needed to cut, and they needed to cut Roxy. And there was a part of it that just couldn't get over cutting Roxy for 2 days because I'm a crazy person. But also she was like taking her daughter
to college.
Yeah. And like there was the Bed Bath and Beyond runs and loading up the Ford Expedition. So, but the Roxy thing, for whatever reason, I just got really attached to, just because I think it was, and they were probably right to cut it because really good editors, you know, but it was a funny thing because I just got really attached to it. And it was just because it was like, no, you need the fully formed character. It wasn't just that she was getting to the bottom of this crime, but she was this working mom who had a dying dog and this daughter going off to school. And you know, you get attached to that stuff.
It's interesting that, you know, she's staying up all night. You paint that as my read on that she's working furiously into the night was, A, she's under time pressure because she realized this is serious, and B, she was like, this is kind of fun.
Oh, I think she actually, another interesting detail that got cut, was she had actually, and I confirmed this with the FBI, she had tried out for the FBI in the 90s when she was in coming out of college in Seattle, and just kind of loved investigating. And so she had gone through several stages and actually gotten invited to a point in the process where I think she had to fly east. And then she realized, like, look, I in no way ever want to live on the – she's just a total West Coast person and just didn't want to live on the East Coast. So she just kind of bagged out of it. And she was 22 or 23, but she did actually get down the road as an FBI recruit. So, yeah.
That's wild. The whole story is wild. Okay, Kevin Arnovitz, you've given me enough of your time on this. The story is on ESPN. Millions of people already read it. But you can find it. It's entitled The Wild Story Behind the NBA's Most Unlikely Heist. And it is just, it's a page. It's, if there were still pages,
there
in
are
the
no
world,
pages anymore.
It,
are there?
It would be a page turner. Kevin Arnovitz, it's always wonderful to see you. Congrats on a great story.
Hey, thanks.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.